Robert Stark here. I am joined here with Sebastian Ronan from the Renaissance Party of North America. Hey, Sebastian, it's nice having you on.
Hello, Mr. Stark. How are you this evening?
Excellent. So, about a week or about 2 weeks ago, I interviewed Max Marco from the Renaissance Party of North America. And he's the chairman of the United States branch, and you're the original founder and chairman of the Canada branch.
That's correct. Now, do you wish some explanation on those divisions and why it is as such?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Well, obviously we are in different legal jurisdictions and different political jurisdictions, so we do have to adhere to that. But putting that aside, we recognize and we work with a common mission statement, a common constitution, and where it at, in some places it has been tweaked, is my understanding from Mr. Macro, again to adapt to those different legal and political contexts, and we all share policy positions to the extent that we can. In other words, where a policy position is not applicable in the American political context, then that position is either not recognized by the American Party, or it's tweaked and adapted to meet that American condition. But where we can, we share those three things in common. And the reason for that is quite simple. We recognize a continental agenda, and within that continental agenda, of course, resides the secessionist agenda, which is our primary agenda. Everything points towards that. The post-collapse fracturing of both these two industrial nation states, the United States of America and Canada. So in our opinion, there is no contradiction there from seeing a from owning a continental scope and a secessionist scope, both as one package.
And one thing I want to point out is in the interview with Max, I mentioned that the platform was Canada-centric, and you commented on that that's not necessarily true.
No, as I just explained, yes, the party was founded here, but within a very short period of time, there were Americans who were also interested in this notion, in this concept, and they came on board fairly early. Officially, the party was founded as are many others in this day and age, as a Facebook group. In December of 2009, I had a contact, a Facebook contact of mine. Well, actually, I knew the other person also. Set up a meeting with the last remaining individual that was connected to the old, what was it called? National Renaissance Party, which was somewhat vibrant in New York City during the 50s, post-war era, into the 60s. And what I needed to gain from this individual was I asked him, is there any paper left outstanding on the National Renaissance Party? And he assured me that there was not, that its only presence in the world was as a Facebook group, of which he was the moderator. And so we agreed that he would turn the Facebook group over to me, which he did. It was all done in very upright, professional manner. And when he did, changed the name of the Facebook group to the Renaissance Party of North America. There was a reason at that time why I felt it was necessary to gain that brand, the Renaissance brand, because I already in December of 2009 had in mind that I would be attending the 2010 AMRAN conference in March of 2010, which I ended up doing. and interest party to the general nationalist public at that point.
So, before you were involved, you started the party, you were involved with the Green Party in Canada. What are your experiences with the Green Party?
Well, it goes back to 1984 to 86, when I was still living in Vancouver, and I was a member of the BC, the British Columbia Green Party, for those 2 years. The BCGP was actually the first Green Party founded on the North American continent. During the second year of those 2 years, I sat on the executive. And there just came a point where I could not see any future for my political interests within the Green Party. And there was a major thing that happened in the mid-80s, is that just after the Green Party of British Columbia was founded, a very short time after, the Federal Green Party of Canada was founded. And in my opinion, that ran contrary to what it meant to be green, because the two major principles of what it meant to be green at the time were decentralization and bioregionalism. And the Federal Party swept both of those under the rug, and you can well imagine why, because it did not suit the purposes of a federal political party. And that has been the case ever since. Now, when I relocated to Nova Scotia in 2001, several years later, in 2007, 2008, sorry, I became a member of the Green Party here in Nova Scotia, which had just been founded. As with so much else here in the Maritimes, everything is around about 25 years behind the time. Which at one time was considered to be a liability, I consider that in this day and age to be an asset. Anyway, based on what had been my experience in BC, I joined the party here, again, provincial party, not federal. I have never been a member of the Federal Canadian Green Party on matter of principle. So I joined the provincial party here in Nova Scotia and took a run at the leadership. With a peak oil, a soft secessionist plank, and a soft nationalist plank, which is really all I could afford to get away with here in Nova Scotia. That
How would you
leadership bid
define
failed miserably. That happened.
a soft nationalist plank?
Sorry, we were breaking up there, Mr. Stark. What was the
Okay,
question
what do
again,
you,
please?
how explicit did you get on the soft nationalist plank for the Green Party?
Let me think. Well, one of my positions that I put forward as wearing the hat of leadership candidates was the introduction to learn Gaelic in Nova Scotia's public schools, because the primary ethnic heritage here is Scots, followed closely by French, by Acadian French. Nova Scotia, well, all of the Maritimes, as is all of Nova Acadia, which is this bioregional entity that is coming to the surface, that combines the Maritimes and the three New England states of Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. That entire region is 97% white Euro. Okay? Now, in Nova Scotia, and I imagine it's the same in the other maritime provinces, I'm not sure about the three American states. There are programs here, government-sponsored programs, to attempt to attract immigrants to Nova Scotia. And what tends to happen is they will come in, they will take the grant money, they will put in their 1 year and try to start a business or sponsor business, etc. And at the end of that year, they are gone. they go to either Montreal, Toronto, or Vancouver. Immigrants just don't like it here. And the 3%, the balance 3%, is made of Native Amerindian, the Mi'kmaq peoples. So there is a small Negro population in Halifax, but it is so minimal that it does not even show up on the official census.
So, I guess you were touching on this. So, you started after your involvement with the Green Party, you started the Renaissance Party. So, it originated from the Facebook group.
Correct. It did. That leadership, that Green Party leadership convention, occurred in October 2009. And this meeting that I had with the representative of the old American Renaissance Party happened in December of 2009. So it was a span of 2 months. I was affiliated with someone who was running a Facebook group called, well, it was the only New Right representation at that time in North America, a New Right group. And that was the transition. I resigned from the Greens. So in total, over what, from 1984 to what have we got now, 2014, what's that, 30 years? I have been a Green Party member all of 3 years. the 2 years in British Columbia and the 1 year here. And I do not see it as a problem vis-a-vis nationalist politics, and especially the way that we have packaged it into our philosophy, incorporating the ecology of race, because it seems to be such a blind spot that all other living matter, etc., on the planet is recognized by the science of ecology, but the human species and its sub races is not included in that worldview. And this is a major blind spot. So we have incorporated that into the field of, well, into the perception of ecology, and we think it has a rightful place there. Of course, it frightens greenie types because they tend to be liberal for the most part. And for standard white nationalists, it confuses them because it's basically very alien. But that is another, just another point, which makes us somewhat unique with our perception and what we propose to offer.
So you're very, I mean, I discuss this with Max, but you're very much opposed to movements that you would describe as reactionary. First of all, what is your definition of reactionary?
Well, reactionary. My understanding of it is what I believe is what the standard understanding of it is in political circles. Reactionary is a sentiment or a movement or a conduct or behavior that gets its hackles up and tries to fight what is inevitable. I mean, time only has one direction, and that's forward, that's ahead. So I would lump the standard conservatives under that label of reactionary. In other words, we are going forward. There is no going back. There is no going back to what we have been. We can mimic the past. We can mimic what we think life was like within certain eras, be that be that the 50s, which I think is ludicrous. I mean, who in God's name wants to go back to the 50s? Or be that National Socialist Germany, or be that the Viking era, or the Roman era, etc., etc. A lot, the traditionalist movement, and I address this in my book, which was published last year. The only thing that is happening is a type of mimicry. Because we don't live it. We don't know. We think what it may have been like. We may recognize certain principles that were dominant within those eras. Take a Satru, for example. And we think we may be living them, but in my opinion, we're really not. We're just mimic. It's a type of mimicry, and if something can be gained from that mimicry, well, great. But we also have to recognize, and it's widely accepted within the nationalist movement, is that we live as a race, as a peoples, under a condition of full-blown, full-bore deracination. The literal translation of that word is pulled up by the roots. Now, it's impossible to be a little bit deracinated. We either are or we aren't. And I lean in the direction of what most other people, that we are. But do they recognize what they are saying? In other words, deracinated is pulled up by the roots. We have been pulled up by the roots. And as I like to word it every now and then, in my opinion, multiculturalism, what people call cultural Marxism, etc. Popular culture has performed, and again, this is my opinion, popular culture has performed a lobotomy on racial memory. Culture is communication. And if those ethics, those values that we mimic, are not, if there's no connection, there's no reality. So we have to reinvent. And this is another one of our sub-slogans, I would say, is that there's nothing left to save, there's everything to reinvent.
So you're saying to start over from the scratch, create something that's brand new, that hasn't been done.
Yes. I mean, I don't know what it is. We are poking in a certain direction, certain directions. And again, this is part of our overall philosophy, is recognizing post-peak oil energy devolution. We are about to be shaken up to such an extent, not only our societies here in North America, but worldwide, because this is a global phenomenon, to such an extent, who knows how it will rearrange everything, everything, our perception on the world, our values, our ethics, our ways of producing and consuming, in other words, our economies. Everything will be up for grabs because it will be such a major and tragic transition to make.
And what are so what is the response that these reactionary movements have to all this? How do they react to it?
Well, from what I can see, some factions think that what is best for white people on the continent is simply return to the good old days of the 1950s, which, in my opinion, was a horrid decade. I mean, just coming off the Second World War, neoliberalism was just gaining a foothold, industrialism was still working towards its peak. One of the things that we recognize that happened during the 50s is that white people everywhere in the West, in the Occidental world, birth rates started declining. It became obvious somewhat in around late 50s. It became obvious for demographers. Now, there are reasons for that, divisions of labor, leisure class was created, the women's movement had not yet been spawned, but eventually did. So what happened is that decision makers, and we are talking like real decision makers, saw that this was coming. And by 1965, in 1965 seems to be the watershed year. A Western country liberalized its immigration policies. It happened in the United States. It happened in Canada,
Did it
in Europe,
happen in Canada the
to
same
open
year?
up the floodgates, basically, because the society, yeah, it did. I mean, the principle of multiculturalism has been officially on the books. It's a statute for 40 years. And again, the immigration policies were liberalized in around, I think, 1966, in around there. It happened in every Western country in around like a 2 or 3 year span, mid-60s.
So the group, so the Facebook group was the that you were involved with was called the North American New Right. I know Countercurrents is known for using that term, the North American New Right. Are that was it affiliated officially with Countercurrents at the time? What came first?
I don't think Countercurrents existed at that point. My understanding is that Facebook group is what Countercurrents is what this Facebook group evolved into. And the individual who was running with it at that time was a man by the name of Christopher Donnellan. Now, if he is still affiliated with that movement or not, and to what degree, I don't know.
Was so Christopher Donnellan, could you tell the audience more about him? I mean, I'm familiar with him from Facebook, but could you tell the audience more about him?
Well, I don't know that much about him. He was one of the original officers of our Renaissance Party Facebook group. And at that time, all I knew about him is that he also, at some point, had been an ex-Green, and he was now interested in this new right movement, which at that time was just starting to penetrate nationalist circles in North America, coming over from Europe. And it also piqued my curiosity at the time, and held my curiosity for about 2 years. It's no longer a priority for me, but at that point, I was very interested in the notion. And Mr. Donlin left our group in the summer of 2010, along with Keith Preston, whom you had on your show last week. And I knew full well that both of them lean towards an identity of national anarchism. We are open to accepting pretty well anyone as long as they are prepared to meet in the middle. Okay, and sometimes that can be a tough challenge. So our doors are open, but we are in process of creating a brand new something, a brand new something, and it all happens at the center. In other words, at that place where radical left and radical right overlap, because the only major thing that still stands between them and keeps them apart is the issue of race and more softly ethnicity.
Yeah, that's a
Because
pretty.
on most other things we see eye to eye
Exactly.
on the environment, on ecology, economics, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing that stands in the way, and it's a major hurdle, it is a major hurdle, is that of race. And we think that with our position of ecology of race, it will make it somewhat softer for lefties to at least look at us. Now, not all will come in. We don't want all, nor do we want all of the right, nor do we want all white nationalists. Our strategy is that if we package our brand carefully and honestly, we would like, theoretically, to grab one out of every five, in other words, 20%.
So, in order, so would you avoid a lot of the type of rhetoric about that issue that would definitely scare off a lot of people, like derogatory, making derogatory comments about different ethnic groups? Would you stay clear of that stuff?
Well, yeah, we try to the best of our ability. I mean, I'm not big on it myself because what's the use of, I mean, it accomplishes nothing really. And unfortunately, from what I see going on for the majority, and again, not all, for the majority of the white nationalist movement is a lot of people, they simply get stuck in a position of cracker good, nigger Jew bad. Now, the world is much more complicated and interwoven than that. So we are prepared, and this is where we really differ from white nationalists, being ethno-nationalists. We are prepared to sit down with whom we consider to be the ethnic stakeholders on this continent. And there aren't many. There are white Europeans, of course. There are Negroes, Amerindians, and also Mexicans. Because let's not forget that El Norte, that district called El Norte, was the first real, somewhat nation, although a Spanish colony that was founded in what is now North America. Because to one degree or another, all of us, well, those of us within the white European community who hold to the secessionist principles, that's what connects us. Whereas a lot of white nationalists, well, I would say most, tend to fall into what I would call the A3P position, and they are still holding out hope that America can be saved. It cannot be saved. It is in process of fracturing. It is in process of imploding. It is in process of breaking apart. The bad guys know it. We know it. So we have prepared for it.
Yeah,
Our mandate looks about.
one example I'll give is I think it's more older people who are nostalgic for America. I mean, I'll give an example. The first major historical event that I remember would probably be like the LA riots. So I see it's mostly older people who have that nostalgia talk about saving America.
Well, yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, this is serious stuff. This is serious stuff. These two institutions, they are social constructs. I mean, they've been around, well, the United States 100 years longer than Canada, but that's all they are. They're just social institutions. They're living things, and living things are born, they live, they die. The empire is dying. The empire is dying, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing, that can be done to reverse that. So if that is the case, then that bullet needs to be bitten upon, and to prepare for what is likely to come. I mean, there will be consequences, but it also opens up a terrific field for creation.
Can you talk more about the significance of peak oil and how it will affect the future of the political system and the economic structure?
Yeah, well, one of the major ways that our understanding of secession differs from the more standard rah-rah jingoistic, and not coming down on them, but I would place groups like League of the South in that camp. In other words, they think it's just a matter of educating people and then seceding. We recognize secession by default. In other words, secession will be a consequence of energy devolution. And here's a rough scenario of what is likely to occur. Most peak oilers, those with an economic understanding of it, agree that the devolution rate will be something like 4% per year, between four, maybe as high as 10. Now, what that means, if you wish to create a picture for yourself in your mind, on a yearly basis, every year there's 4% less cars on the road, 4% less jobs, 4% less lights on, 4% less engines running, 4% less electronic motors running, et cetera, because our entire society is energy dependent. Okay? And once that kicks in, there's no reversing it. There's no reversing it. Now, people say, well, yes, but we have alternative energy sources. This is true. But there is no known combination of all, I repeat, of all alternatives, be it wind, solar, hydro, thermal, and nuclear, that can displace the scale. The scale is the blind spot, the scale of oil. And once that happens, if we are looking at hypothetically a 20% or 30% unemployment, the federal government is short the equal 20%, 30% tax revenue. The infrastructure is already starting to crumble. There will be no money to invest in infrastructure. Transportation shuts down. There was a point in 2008, July 2008, when a barrel peaked at, I think, $147. And there was one story that was very indicative of what is likely to happen across the board. There was a story of a trucker, in other words, an independent, one day arrived. He just pulled his rig over to the side of the road, shut it down, left the keys on the dashboard, and in other words, he could no longer make it work. Now, when you consider, depending on whose stats you run across, anywhere from 70% to 90% of a barrel of oil goes towards transportation, be it highway, be it rail, be it air, be it water. And if that shuts down, everything shuts down. Because in the average North American city, the average food supply, quote unquote food, because it's mostly some GMO stuff, but that stuff on the shelves, the average supply is about 10 days.
So what it would basically do is forced communities and economies to become localized.
Well, they would have to assume local responsibility. The federal government would physically, would structurally no longer be able to hold the sway over regions that currently does. And this is our understanding of secession by default. Everything implodes, everything fractures, and people have to assume responsibility. Everything whittles down to a much smaller scale, to a much slower scale. And some regions will get it, and some regions won't. So we have to accept that. There's nothing that one region will be able to do for another region. And this is why, in one sense, our understanding of ethno-nationalism is so radical and potentially so brutal. Because let's take hypothetically into consideration the creation of a Negro state somewhere on the North American continent. At that point, they either get their shit together or they die. It's that simple. And the problem is resolved within two or three generations. Because we will all be on our own. We all have to recognize and honor and accept if we accept this notion of ethno-nationalism as it truly should be. In other words, we'll separate, we will all develop our own societies, and we'll take it from there. And you either get it or you don't.
And I know on your website you have this, it's a hypothetical map, so it's not set in stone, but how Canada and the United States would be carved up into a bunch of smaller nations.
Yeah, there are a lot of those maps on how possibly these two countries will break apart. I mean, ours is one. Ours does tend towards more of a bioregional perception, if I may. Now, there are cultural overlaps that will have to be taken into consideration, and you're correct. It's hypothetical, it's theoretical only. The major purpose that it serves is to get people to alter their perception. In other words, when they look at a map of North America, they do not see these two redundant social institutions, these industrial nation states called the United States of America and Canada. They see a whole different perception of what could be, of what could be. Now, in my opinion, I would imagine in maybe 1 or 2 years, when our membership has grown to the point that we will have a very good conference where there will be enough delegates at that conference to represent every major region on the continent. And at that point, it will be the responsibility of the delegates to determine, okay, let's how do we break it down? So there will be some negotiating to do. We may or may not at that point have Mexican, Negro, and Amerindian members. If we are due to our principle of ethno-nationalism, I personally don't see how that could not be the case, because we are proposing to work in partnership with them to not fight them.
Yeah, someone was saying, I forget if it was you or Max, but these people talking about like Rahoa, all that would do, it would just provoke like a massive crackdown by the police state. If anything, the powers that be would want to provoke something like that.
Well, true. I believe that there will be some extent of racial conflict. Now, what that extent will be, we don't know. Our preference would be as minor as possible. Now, I'm of the opinion, it's not a party position, but I'm of the opinion that Rahoa probably has been for some time being co-opted by the quote-unquote globalists, the bad guys, and that, I mean, that's what they do. They do it very well. They co-opted the Green Movement. Why would they not co-opt Rahoa? In other words, when they see something coming over the horizon, and they run their numbers and they run their models, et cetera, and they see that, yeah, this is coming, same thing with global warming, they will turn it around to meet and feed their interests. So I am convinced that this thing called Rahoa will be sprung on their time, on their dime, and to suit their purposes.
And yeah, you also touched on the global warming thing as an example. Can you get into more detail about your thoughts on global warming?
Well, my academic background is a very strong systems theory. So I can't, for myself, I have to recognize some degree of man-made global warming. Now, what that degree is, that's what is contentious. In other words, yes, there's activity on the sun, and that is obviously a factor, but there has to be some degree of man-made global warming. Now, the most where the whole philosophy sits these days, as I understand it very, very roughly, is that most of the heat is being trapped by the Earth's oceans. And let's remember that 70, 75% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. So the heat is being deflected back into the oceans, and that is where it's being retained. And we are starting to see the horror show that awaits us over the horizon. These methane pimples that have started appearing in Siberia. There was a report that was forwarded to me just yesterday, the extent to which the oceans are warming up, and that methane patches have now been discovered just off the coast of America. And if that is the case, then we are in process of heating up our oceans, which of course in turn, within a system's dynamic, will melt the ice caps, et cetera. The oceans will die. They will turn an ungodly red, if you can believe it. That's the, you know, the scenario is just unbelievable. And we have passed the tipping point, that ecological tipping point. It is now visible in our rear mirror, as is the case with peak oil. It's behind us. We're on the other side of that. We live in an era of peak everything. And once that tipping point has been crossed, we find ourselves on death ground. We really are on death ground. And the worst case scenario is that, you know, roughly about 5 billion people, which is a direct consequence of the industrial era, which is no more than a 200-year pimple upon the passage of time, About 5 billion people on this planet are along for a free ride. And that's the amount that will be taken out, because the carrying capacity of a non-industrial planet, as was the case around 1900, is about 2 billion. That's all it can handle.
So could you touched on your book, Anschluss. Could you talk a little bit more about the book in detail?
Well, it's the best statement, the clearest statement that I was capable of making, and I pushed it to the edge to the best of my ability, because in my opinion, that's what is necessary to do. Not only in my small little life, but I think for all peoples. I mean, we are really, really, really up against the wall. And fortunately, most people are clueless. They're just simply ignorant of to what extent we are up against the wall. Because if, say hypothetically, if at the snap of a finger everyone was clued in, I mean, people would be eating guns, they'd be jumping off bridges, et cetera, because they wouldn't be able to handle it. So I have compressed a lot of what we have just discussed over the last 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes, and expanded on, of course, into book length. It's a 400-page book. This understanding of where we sit as a peoples, the challenges ahead of us, and I mean, it's not pretty in many sections, and it's not intended to be pretty. It's pretty rough, and I will take the consequences for it. I mean, I own it. I own it as an individual human being, as a man alive upon this planet at this stage of our history. I own it as the president of the Renaissance Party of North America, Canada. I have to own it. So we'll see. I mean, it's in the world. It's trickling. But that's all that can be expected. Because the audience for it is very narrow. And it may grow somewhat. But it's not going to be a blockbuster, and I'm not anticipating it to be. But there is that element out there, and again, that element is the curious element, that element that's coming together at that place, at that vesica piscis, where radical left meets radical right. Because everyone and their dog in the political community is chasing third position. So this is one more effort, not only at chasing third position, but identifying it and explaining, in my opinion, why it is coming about, how it is coming about, and what are to be the most likely consequences as they affect the white European race specifically, but other races as well, because this planet has become very, very, very tiny, and we're all connected now. We're all along for the same ride, and here it comes. There are some very ugly, nasty days just around the corner, and it's much closer than most people think.
So you got some controversy for comments you made about the Anders Breivik massacre in Norway?
Well, yes and no. There was some criticism, and My comments came via an essay that was published like within a week or within 2 weeks of that event, and then followed up by a video. And it's not so much that I am pro Breivik or necessarily even pro what he did. I mean, it was a horrid thing to do. But my point was that, look, this event now in the world, it needs to be recognized. And so where do we go with it? How do we go with it? And that was my main. Now, what has happened, and I mean, there were some serious consequences that I, as an individual, had to pay. I mean, I had both the RCMP and CSIS, which is the Canadian CIA, show up at my door, wanting to know who this statement out there. Obviously, someone's button, because that stuff doesn't happen. It doesn't fall out of the sky. So at some level, my position, my commentary, both the essay and the video, press some buttons. And when I look back on it over the last 3 years, and the way things have gone in Europe and also in North America, but specifically we're talking now about the European theater. I have to say for myself and for Anders Breivik is that as horrid as it was the proper thing to do, and he has confirmed it in private correspondence that my take on what he did was correct, and it was probably the only one that was correct. So, in other words, he was drawing attention to the fact that the betrayal stems from within. The gates
Okay,
have
I
been
get what you're
opened
saying.
from
So
the
you're not,
inside. Who is the who? Yeah, who is accountable here? Are the ruling elites of all Western nations? That's who is accountable. That's where the
you're
problem
not
resides.
necessarily endorsing the massacre itself, but you're saying that Anders Breivik brought attention to that issue. Is that a good way to word it?
Yes, yeah, and at the time also, in 2011, the other thing that was taking off, especially for the North American nationalist audience, was Guillaume Fay's book, Archaeofuturism, and Mr. Fay made the argument quite clearly in that book is that what we have lost and what all other races, the colonizers have retained, is our chaos. In other words, our gut connection to being alive. We don't know how to fight. And if you look at history, you will never see a movement that became a successful political movement and revolution minus political terror. That is a fact of life. That is reality. We have, as we speak, we have 10-year-old Muslims, videotaping themselves, chopping off heads, and putting the videos on YouTube. And we freak out because we had one white guy who did an act of political terror, which is what it was. It was an act of political terror.
So,
And it has to be seen as such.
before I wrap up the show, is there anything else about these topics you'd like to add?
I don't think so, Mr. Stark. I mean, thank you very much for covering what I believe are some fairly important points, and for allowing me to clarify on these, because there is so much confusion, so much misunderstanding, and a lot of it is intentional, because after all, I mean, this is political. We do live in a political world. There is competition going on out there. And the Renaissance Party of North America, the RPN, is a player, as I say, where both parties are incorporated. We are both legal entities. We are both in a position to field candidates in 2015 in Canada, in 2016 in the United States, and we are not going away. Ethno-nationalism is a direct competitor to white nationalism, and that's where the friction lies. And so be it. We will do what we do, and white nationalists are welcome to do what they do. We are distinct, we are different political philosophies, both purporting to do what we do on behalf of the North American white European race. But we
Well,
just do it in different ways. Our perceptions are different.
Well, I'd like to thank Sebastian Rodin for being on the show. That's all we have for today's
Are
show.
we done?
Yeah, that's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.